Chapter 1 Suicide Kings. Something, perhaps the year of living by the skin of his teeth on occupied Geryon, or merely the fact of having been born a sly and ruthless son of a bitch, had given Major Rowan of the Tanith First a certain edge. He could usually smell trouble coming. That morning, he could definitely smell trouble coming. As edges went, his was as fine and sharp as the one along the blade of a straight silver war knife. At dawn, with the twin suns beginning to burn up through the petrochemical smog across the city bay, he left the regimental billet and walked down to the rockcrete wasteland of the bayside revetment. There he wandered as far as the bridge and crossed over to the pontoons in front of the island guardhouse. The pontoon walkway clunked underfoot. Looking down through the mesh, he could see the water, toxic, brown and frothy. The massive galvanic plants along the bay, Adeptus Mechanicus developments that powered and lit the Hive City's core systems, had just flushed their heat sinks and filled the coastline with its morning dose of radioactive effluent. There was steam in the air, steam that stank of sulphur and rolled like a fog bank, white in the sun's light. The waters of the bay and estuary had been corrosively acidic for 1,000 years. It was sobering to think that anything still lived in it. But things did. Just below the surface, they squirmed and moved, leech-mouthed, slug-slick, with dentition like crowded pincushions and eyes like phlegm. Rowan could see them, following him beneath the surface, a dark, wriggling mass. What gave them their edge? Was it the sound of his footsteps, the passing heat signature of his body, pheromones, his shadow in the water? They were survivors. They had adapted to their environment instead of allowing it to kill them, and they killed anything that threatened them. Just like him. 3 Urdeshi troopers were manning the guardhouse. They didn't know him, and he didn't know them. They weren't his concern. He had chosen that particular morning because it was pretty much the last chance he was going to get before the regiment shipped out. The point of no turning back had been reached. But still, there was the nagging discomfort of his edge. Something was off. Something was wrong. He'd chosen the wrong day to try it. Maybe the troopers suspected him of something. Maybe they were wired up for some reason. Maybe something had given away his true intent. Under ordinary circumstances, the doubt would have been enough to make him abort, turn around and go home. The uncertainty would have been sufficient to make him blow it off and try again another day when the odds were more favourable. Except there weren't going to be any more other days. It was now or it was never. There were no more chances. The monster, that monster, should have been dead long since. Justice and decency demanded it, and only the dedicated efforts of good men who ought to have known better were ensuring the monster's salvation. Dedication. Rowan had always possessed a measure of dedication. He knew what was right and what was wrong. He knew when an order was a bad thing and needed to be ignored. He knew that sometimes a man had to be counterintuitive. A man had to do what looked like a bad thing so that everything else would be right in the end. The monster was destined to die. Its death was required, demanded. Efforts had already been made by more than one interested party. Rowan couldn't stand by and let things carry on. Rowan was a man of serious convictions, after all. Thankfully, they'd all been wiped from his record the day he joined the Imperial Guard. The Urdeshi watched him as he approached. What did they suspect? Did they know what he had really come for? He stopped at the outer cage gate. The Urdeshi troopers wore black metal pins that indicated they had been seconded to serve the Commissariat's S Company, the close protection and security detail. They asked him his name and his business and studied the papers he passed through the metal letterbox. One of them took a long time over the contact permission document, signed by Rowan's commanding officer, as though he had literacy problems. They let him through. They checked his ID tags. They eyed his tattoos with scorn. He was some kind of heathen farmhead from an agri world, an indentured barbarian, not a proper fighting man from a civilised place like Urdesh. Only his rank kept the insults at bay. They took his sidearm, put it in the guardhouse locker, and made him sign for it. Then they patted him down. The Urdeshi had been fairly thorough up until that point, but now the long night shift and a clutch of caffeine headaches began to show. Ron had been patted down by the very best in his time. He knew precisely how to twist or turn, innocent movements that looked like balance-keeping, so that even somebody taking the pat-down seriously could be misled and misdirected. Ron kept his hands raised. By the time they'd finished, they would believe they had methodically checked everywhere, where, in fact, he had kept them entirely clear of one or two areas. They found the knife, Tanith war knife, straight silver, buckled to his right shin.
"What's this?" asked one.
"Back up," replied Rowan. They took it, made him sign for it. He'd wanted them to find it. It was the decoy. People believed they'd done a thorough job if they found something. People usually stopped searching at that point.
"You've got 30 minutes," said one of the guards. "That is the permitted duration authorised by your papers. You will be back here in 29 minutes. If you're not, we will come looking for you, and you will be considered a justified target."
Rowan nodded. They opened the inner cage gate. Its chain hoist clattered. He walked through the guardhouse and out onto the inner causeway of the pontoons. The tide clearly caught here between the vast stone piers of the island. There was a pronounced stink of sulphur and a soupy mass of dissolving garbage lapped against the slimy walls of the inlet. He left the pontoon walkway and climbed stone steps that brought him in under the archway entrance. The island was an artificial atoll of stone and rockcrete built to support a squat, formidable lighthouse tower. The bridge that had originally connected to the shore had long since rotted away. It had been replaced by the metal pontoon and the walk span. The lighthouse hadn't burned for a long time. Dark and neglected, the tower's thick walls and inaccessibility had been put to other uses. Once he was out of sight of the guardhouse, Ron stepped back into the shadows. He reached down to his left calf and removed the other Tanith war knife he was carrying. He had tied it around his shin with bootlaces. The one he'd surrendered had been Merin's. Ron had taken it without asking. Merin would probably be searching his billet for it already. It added to Ron's enjoyment of the whole enterprise to think that, whatever else happened, Merin would end up on a charge for misplacing his regimental dagger. Ron believed the knife would probably be enough. It certainly ought to be enough for any self-respecting Tanithborn to get the job done. But he wanted to cover all the variables. Off to the side of the lowering entrance archway was a dim stone cistern. It had once been the chute of a guardrobe, or a drainaway built to cope with heavy storm swells. The edge of his war knife, deftly applied, freed the lip of the cast-iron cover. Ron hooked his fingers around the bars of the cover and lifted it out. There was a damp stone well underneath, with water lurking in the darkness at the bottom. Other things lurked down there too, things with pincushion gums and egg-white eyes. He could hear them slopping and writhing gleefully, as if entertained by his cunning. The cord had been attached to the underside of the drain cover, so that it hung down into the shaft of the well, weighted by the wax burlap musette bag on the end. He pulled the line up, and the bag with it, opened the drawstring top, and took out the heavy object wrapped in visi-cloth. It was a collection of objects, in fact, all of them dense and heavy, machined metal components, Ron spread the cloth on the stone floor beside the drain and laid the parts out on it. He slotted them together quickly and skillfully. He'd done it 1,000 times before. He could have done it blindfold. Each piece clacked or wound into place. The smell of gun oil was sweet and strong in his nostrils. Standard Munitorum issue Laz pistol, Kulan 5 pattern. It was one of the original stamped blanks shipped from Kulan for finishing in the armories of Tanith, prior to issue at the Tanith founding. The palm spur had been fitted with a handmade Nalwood grip, and age and use had lent the figuring greater beauty than any varnish or lacquer could have achieved. The pistol had been smuggled into the lighthouse over a period of weeks, one part at a time. It lacked a power cell, a flash sleeve, and the side casings. Ron reached into his belt pouch. Inside were 2 cigars rolled in black licorice paper. The S Company sentries had taken them out, sniffed them, and given them back. Each cigar was in a little tin case, except they weren't. One of the tin cases was actually a flash sleeve. Ron blew out the traces of tobacco fibre and screwed the sleeve onto the end of the barrel. The Urdeshi had also failed to notice that he was wearing 4 tags, not 2. Ron unlooped the 2 side plates from the slender chain, dropped the tags back down under the neckline of his vest, and slotted the side plates into position. Then he struck the tip of his knife into the back of his boot heel and pulled the heel block away from the upper. The power cell was secured in a cavity he'd hollowed out of the heel. Ron stamped the heel back in place, then slapped the cell into the gun. He toggled off, armed it, got a tiny green light on the grip just above his thumb. He felt the ambient hum of a charged las weapon. He dropped the drain cover back, slipped the knife into his belt, and walked up the steps from the entrance archway with the pistol down at his side in his right hand. There was a semicircular stone chamber beyond, large and full of echoes. Munitorum issue armoured window units had been bolted or heat-fused into the gaping stone sockets. Ron passed on into a larger stone chamber, fully circular and 3 or 4 stories high. It was the core of the lighthouse. In the base, dead centre, stood some of the old lampwork, a great engineered brass contraption with a wick mount, winding handles, and a reservoir feed from the promethium sump below. A huge frame of gearing and chain lines surrounded it to elevate the lamp to the beacon room at the apex of the tower once it was lit. The brass lampwork was black with age, and the chains had rusted. The gears and winders were so corroded they had frozen, blotched green and white, and would never turn again. Decades of dust had accreted on the black grease of the lamp head and wick assembly in such quantity it looked like some exotic, thickly furred animal mounted on display. Ron walked up the stairs that ran around the curve of the chamber wall. There was no rail, and he made no sound. Though the latter was not even deliberate. Like many Tanith, he had been taught by that great educator, life, not to give himself away. He smelled caffeine and the unmistakable aroma of fried nutrition fibre. Slab, staple of the common Lasman's diet, cornerstone of guard rations. Ron reached a landing space. There was a doorway ahead. A guard, another Urdeshi man, was sitting beside the doorway on a chair borrowed from another building. Ron kept the las pistol against his hip so that the man wouldn't see it immediately. He kept walking. It was all about confidence. Confidence was the key to everything. Use enough of it and you could pull off any scam, win any fight or bed any mamsel. The more you acted like you were absolutely supposed to be doing something, the less chance anyone would ask what the hell you were up to, until it was too late. And they were, depending on the circumstances, financially worse off, dead, or surprisingly naked. The guard didn't spare him a second look. Ron passed him and went in through the doorway. The room had originally been the Tower Master's chamber. It was bare boards and grilled windows, and the corkscrew staircase ran up the inside wall to the platform levels higher in the tower. The room currently contained a heavy wooden cot, a small trolley table, and an old wooden chair. The cot was neatly made, the blanket and bedroll laid out as if for a barrack hall inspection. On the table was a small lumen lamp, some books, and a cookhouse tray. On the tray was a tin cup and a flask of caffeine, a salt shaker, a mess dish with the remains of a serving of slab cake, hard biscuits and refried bean paste, and a worn metal spoon. Ron was surprised they'd allowed a spoon. A determined man could turn a spoon into a weapon. He could sharpen it against stone, stab with it. If he didn't have time to work its edge, he could improvise. Even blunt, it could do damage to an eye or a throat if driven with enough force. Maybe it's me, Ron thought. Maybe I just see weapons and everything. Maybe, to other people, that's just a spoon. The books were all imperial tracts and transmissionary pamphlets, stamp-printed on brown, low-quality paper. It was all the monster ever seemed to read. He said they helped to settle him and fortify his resolve. The monster was sitting in the chair beside the table, reading one of the tracts while he digested his breakfast. He was wearing unmarked black fatigues, boots and a brown hide jacket. His shaved scalp and face were covered in deliberate ritual scars, old and puckered, but the hands holding the transmissionary treatise were soft and unmarked. The monster became aware of Ron's approach. He stopped reading and looked up.
"Major Ron," he said, "I did not expect to see you this morning."
So damn polite. Like a real person. "Fergus," Ron replied. The monster looked startled for a second. It wasn't just the fact that he had been called traitor in his own abhuman tongue. It was the fluency of it. Ron's time on occupied Geryon had allowed him to acquire a conversational grasp of the archenemy language. He didn't merely know the word for betrayer. He could deliver it with colloquial authenticity. It was as though a part of the monster's old life had come back to threaten him. The monster saw the weapon. He saw Ron raising the last pistol from the guarded place beside his hip.
"Major," he began.
Ron said nothing else. He took aim and fired. The crack of the discharge echoed around the room. Ron heard seabirds roosting in the upper parts of the lighthouse launch into the air at the sound of the shot. Nothing else. Footsteps. There would be footsteps. Which side would they come from? What angle did he need to cover? Ron looked at the monster. The monster, Mabon Etagor, looked back at him. "Come on, or you're a dead man," Ron said. Mabon got up out of his chair. Ron's shot had severed the heavy iron chain that linked the Etagor's manacles to a hefty floor pin. He looped up the trailing cut end of the chain around his right hand.
"I don't understand," Mabon said.
"No time to explain," Ron replied. It was going to be from the right. The sea window blew in, exploding in a spray of armoured glass fragments. There was a man outside, on the lighthouse's external walkway. Ron tackled Mabon and brought him down behind the trolley table in the cot. Three more last shots shrieked in through the blown window space and scorched holes in the opposite wall. Prone, Mabon looked at Ron. Ron gestured for him to keep down. The shooter outside switched his las rifle to full auto and unleashed a storm of rounds into the room. Several struck the side of the heavy cot, splintering the wood and slamming the frame backwards. Some hit the trolley table and knocked it over. Some punctured the back of the old chair and filled the air with dust and floating animal hair fibres.
Silence.
Dust and smoke drifted in the sunlight. Mabon looked set to move. Ron, still flat on his belly, reached out and picked up the salt shaker that had been knocked off the tray. He used it like a pen and drew on the stone floor in salt. The looping white lines formed the scratch symbol for play dead. The blood-packed scratch symbol. Some said Ron had learned far more on Geryon than was entirely good for him. Mabon looked at the symbol and nodded. The shooter was cautious. He had killed the guard at the door before Ron's arrival, cut his throat and left him sitting in his chair. Then he'd gone out onto the walkway and circled around, probably intending to get up and fire at Mabon from above. The noise of Ron's shot had forced him to make his play earlier than he had intended. A minute passed. A full minute. It felt like a year to the two men pressed down on the floor behind the cot as they tried not to twitch or breathe. A second minute was almost up before something moved against the light and a figure stepped in through the blown window. An Urdeshi trooper by his clothes and his Laz rifle. Uniforms and guard-issue weapons could be stolen. The boots crunched on the broken glass. Ron let him get a metre or so into the room, then fired under the cot. The last shot clipped the man's left calf and he toppled with a squeal. Ron leapt up at once, bounding over the battered cot to finish things. He was hoping to take the man alive for interrogation, but he was also fully prepared to seal the deal with a kill shot if necessary. He almost fell off the cot mid-bound as shots tore down from above. A second shooter was firing from high up inside the tower, perched on the railless spiral of the stairs. Ron landed on top of the first shooter. It was an accident, but he worked with it. The man fought back. Ron saw his face close up and recognised him. They wrestled. Shots from above struck the floor beside them. The man had Ron's wrist. Ron couldn't aim his pistol. The man's Laz rifle, looped around the man's torso and his strap, was wedged between them. Ron threw a hooking punch. He couldn't aim with the pistol, so he struck with it. The butt collided with the man's cheek and snapped his head around. But the impact tore the pistol out of Ron's grip, and it went skittering away across the floor. More shots struck the ground around them from above. Ron rolled over hard, dragging his dazed assailant with him, like two lovers tumbling. He couldn't pull the Laz rifle off the shooter because of the strap, but he got his right hand around the barrel to direct it and his left hand down and low to squeeze the trigger. The weapon was still set on full auto. Laz shots hosed up the throat of the lighthouse, deflecting off the curved walls, blowing out chunks of brick and stonework. It wasn't the cleanest piece of shooting Ron had ever executed, but he managed to drag the chasing wildfire across the section of screw stair where the second shooter was crouching. Hit, though perhaps not fatally, the second shooter yelped and fell. He somersaulted down a dozen steps, cracking off the stone edges and then grazed against the curve of the wall and flew right off the staircase entirely. He dropped 8 metres straight down onto the prisoner's wooden chair, which exploded into kindling and dust under the impact. Ron was up. There was no opportunity for respite. A third assassin had appeared, rushing in through the main doorway. Like the other two, he was dressed as an Urdeshi trooper. He had a Laz rifle with a bayonet fixed. He too had a face Ron knew. Ron's Laz pistol was out of reach. The Laz rifle was tangled around the body of the first shooter on the floor. Ron went at the third attacker instead, closing the distance between them as fast as he could, ripping out his war knife. The third assassin fired, but Ron's straight silver had already parried his bayonet and turned the muzzle aside. The shot went out through the blown window. The assassin tried to re-aim, but Ron fenced with his blade again and deflected the bayonet so that the next shots went clean up the tower space. The assassin tried to club Ron with an underswing of his tilted rifle. Ron spun his war knife so that the pommel was behind his thumb, then punched the blade sideways, knuckles up. The blow slashed the assassin's throat, left to right. Blood gouted into the air as though someone had tossed a beaker of red ink. Ron ripped back in the opposite direction and tore a second cut across the man's torso, right to left. The assassin fell on his knees with a dead weight thump, his lifeblood exiting his body under pressure through the two huge splits. He collapsed onto his face. Rowan stepped back, spinning the war knife back upright in his hand, and then swung around, alerted by a sound from behind him. The first shooter had got back up on his hobbled leg, raising his rifle to his broken cheek to shoot Rowan in the back. But Mabon had seized him from behind. The Etagor's broken manacles were wrapped around the man's throat, crushing the life out of him. Mabon's face was absolutely expressionless. The man struggled and made a cracked, choking noise. Mabon slammed his face into the stone surround of the blown window and then let the chain go slack, dropping him dead on the floor.
"The timing of your visit was quite fortunate," he remarked.
Rowan nodded, picking up the third assassin's rifle in case there were any further surprises. The three dead assassins all had the same face.
"Rhyme wants you dead," he said. "Half the sector wants me dead," Mabon replied.
Rowan shrugged.
"So, did you get some kind of tip-off that Rhyme was sending his circle after me today?"
"No," said Rowan. "This was a coincidence. I came here this morning to prove a point."
"A what point?"
"That the Tanith First can protect you better than the S Company details the Commissariat assigns to you. We've all used our visits in the last few weeks to test security, to look for weakness, to smuggle things in. Today, I was going to demonstrate that if we could get a weapon inside, so could anybody, and thus convince the Commissariat to assign S Company duties to my platoon, so that we could take over from the buffoons they've been using to watch you.
Because Gaunt would be happier that way. Because he trusts his own to do the job properly."
"Something like that," said Rowan. "And it's Colonel Commissar Gaunt to you."
"My apologies," said Mabon.
Rowan looked at the bodies. Outside, you could hear men approaching, and an alarm started to sound. "Still," he said, "as demonstrations go, this proved the point well enough."
"I'm pleased that my security will be your business for the remainder of my stay here, Major," Mabon said.
"The Suicide Kings will look after you," said Rowan.
"Suicide Kings? Like the card game?"
"Never mind. It's a private joke," said Rowan. "Anyway, there won't be much of a remainder. That's why I had to make my point today. It's also why Rhyme had to make his move. That suggests he has good intelligence."
"You're moving me. We're going to begin at last."
"Approval has been granted," said Rowan. "The mission has been authorised. We make shift at nightfall tomorrow."
"I take it that when we make shift, we will be en route to Salvation's Reach?"
Mabon Etagor asked. "That's classified," said Rowan.